Well, this is class 7 already of Copernicus and the Jews. It's hard to believe, but we've gone through 6 chapters already. And the title of chapter 7, if I got it correctly, I thought we were going to be talking about... Oh, you know what? I read the wrong chapter for today. It's okay. We can still talk about it. This is the correct one. I read chapter 8. I thought it was about the eudaioi. I guess because it seemed to flow so naturally from last time. I've read the other one, too. So we can talk about both of them together a little bit. But the title of chapter 7 is actually Theopolitical Rulers. The rulers had him killed. And... this follows, of course, on the topic from last week, which was the idea that the Jewish people as a whole responded very positively to Yeshua, whereas the main exception to that was the top political and religious leaders who responded very negatively. And the chapter 8, which I actually focused on for today, is... also following on the same theme. It talks about the translation of eudaioi, which is usually given in English New Testaments as the Jews, but should be translated differently and usually refers to these theopolitical rulers that are described in chapter 7. So we'll get into that more as the evening goes on. But as always, I like to follow up a little bit on what we discussed last time. And the first thing, actually, is from Matthew 5. We were discussing the fact that Yeshua said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." And we couldn't get it quite right. We had different suggestions. But the actual verse says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I just wanted to note that because we had all sorts of different ideas on the recording. And the context for... discussing that was just to describe what Yeshua's teaching actually was and why the crowds were attracted to him, why people flocked to him. Part of it was the healing, of course, that he provided. Part of it was the teaching, which was very simple and very comforting. Now, in that discussion, we also talked about why people followed him in terms of whether or not they knew he was the Messiah. And some definitely believed that he was the Messiah, both before his death and resurrection and after it. But one verse that came up was in Matthew 16, when Yeshua says to his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And here's the answer, and they said, "Some say Yohanan Hamatvil, John the Immerser, others Eliyahu, still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." So these are different things, these are different opinions that people held about him at the time. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And then note Yeshua's answer, which is very interesting in the context. He says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Yonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." So it's kind of a special thing that Peter recognizes this. It's not as though everyone recognized it. It was a revelation from God that Peter recognized this. And I think last class, our Peter was making the point that some of the other disciples at different times recognized it as well. But it's not as though everyone who responded positively to him necessarily knew that he was the Messiah. They followed him for a variety of reasons. Now, a third point that I wanted to point to was from Luke 24. And this is the situation when Yeshua appears to... two men who are on the road to Emmaus, and it said it's about 7 miles from Jerusalem, so they were walking there. And in their conversation, they say basically, you know, to Yeshua, who they don't recognize, "You must be the only person who doesn't know what's been going on in Jerusalem these past few days." One of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" As if he didn't know. And they said to him, "The things about Yeshua the Nazarene, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word in the sight of God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to the sentence of death and crucified him." So there you have the statement of eyewitnesses that kind of sums up the argument both in chapter 6 and in chapter 7 of Copernicus and the Jews, their own account of what was going on. First of all, Yeshua was a prophet mighty in word and in deed in the sight of God and all the people. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, at the same time, the chief priests and our rulers delivered him up to the sentence of death and crucified him. So it makes a clear distinction there between the acceptance of the vast majority of people and the rejection and successful attempt to kill him on the part of the rulers and chief priests, who are, of course, in what Christians call the gospel accounts, blamed for it. It's just not really recognized that way for other reasons of interpretation, and also because of the translation in John of the Jews, which we'll get to next time. Now, still continuing on this point of the acceptance of the Jews of Yeshua, I want to point out that the question itself is problematic. If you say, did the Jews accept Yeshua, or did the Jews reject Christ? The question itself is problematic in the same way that it's problematic to say, did the Africans accept Yeshua, or do Americans accept Jesus? Because some do and some don't. And to make an overgeneralization like that is problematic. There isn't a single yes or no answer to that particular question. But what we can see is that in the accounts that we have, vast numbers of Jews responded positively to him, and there were some who didn't respond positively.
Yeah. I was curious if most people at that time were better educated than people came to be later, where they were refused to read the Bible.
I don't know that that question can be answered with any certainty. I mean, are you saying were they more educated then than they are now?
Were the people educated enough to be able to say, oh, he fulfills prophecy? Or were they just kind of, wow, he's a great dude. You know, he heals people and sweet, you know.
Well, obviously there was a range. I mean, as in all times and places, some people went to temple or synagogue, you know, every week and heard the Torah and the prophets being read continually. Others didn't. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm not sure if it might be like a societal thing where everybody went or not.
Well, there was what they call Am HaAretz, the, you know, countrymen, you know, that they didn't know much, and then there were people that related with the synagogues, and, you know, it's mixed bag.
Yeah, but I guess you could say that in general, in the ancient world, Jews tended to be more educated than other peoples, more literate, let's say, than other peoples, because they were focused on the study of God's word. So, actually, basically everywhere in the world where the Jews spread, even places like India and China, they were referred to as people of the book, because it was unusual for so many people to be literate in the ancient world, in a society. But within that, of course, there's a wide spectrum of education, as Fred was pointing out.
They were learning a lot of the Torah by heart. They just knew, they memorized it, because it was not written.
Some people. I mean, probably some people had memorized passages, but not everyone. Yeah. I mean, again, it's partly speculation, because we don't have information that tells us in precise detail these things. In any event, I hope that that point is clear, at least, the idea that it's problematic even to put it in those terms. And the reason it's put in those terms, actually, of did the Jews accept Jesus or reject him, is because of this dichotomy that has been put into place between Jews and Christians, which is a false dichotomy. The Jews did not accept or reject him necessarily, any differently than any other people group would accept or reject him. And so if you talk about Gentiles, well, did Gentiles accept Yeshua? Certainly not all Gentiles accepted Yeshua. Certainly the majority of Gentiles never accepted Yeshua. But because of these errors of translation and interpretation, the idea is presented that the Jews rejected and the Christians, the Gentiles, accepted. That's a false impression in both instances and an overgeneralization. Just as if you were to say, for example, did Americans accept Bush or did the Americans accept Clinton? Well, some did and some didn't. Okay. Any comments or questions on that particular issue?
I just wanted to comment following on the literacy thing that even if you were unliterate or illiterate, a lot of those went to synagogue to hear it. They may not have been able to read it, but they went to hear it.
Right.
So there was a lot of faith in the country.
Yeah. So, again, I mean, it's hard to say whether people would have been able to tell that specific prophecies were being fulfilled or not. I mean, some of the prophecies are hard to figure out until you have them explained, but certainly some of them they might have been able to understand. Now, another point that I wanted to make, partly on the basis of last time, but also in general, is that the purpose of this class is not to convince you that this is Jewish. The Word of God, in other words, or, you know, what, or these writers that we're discussing, Matityahu, for example. If that's all that comes out of this class, then I think it's inadequate. Because it's almost like trying to convince someone that Abraham Lincoln was American. There's nothing to argue about, really. It's just a simple matter of where he was born and the society in which he grew up. And if someone doesn't accept that Abraham Lincoln was American, then at a certain point, there's not really much more to say. So that's not the argument so much here. It's sort of obvious that these things are Jewish and that they come from a Jewish context. The issue is, what consequences does that have? How does that change our understanding of the text? How is the interpretation different? I don't want to try to persuade you that Dostoevsky was Russian, and I don't want to try to persuade you that Shaul or Paul was Jewish, Israeli, because these are just simple matters of the evidence that we have. But it may help to know that Dostoevsky was Russian if you want to understand some of what he wrote. And it may help to understand some of what Paul wrote. It may help to know that he was Jewish and he was writing from that perspective if you want to understand what Paul wrote. And the same thing with Yeshua, of course. It says he was born in Bethlehem of Judea, a specific place, specific people. He grew up in the Galilee, specific place, specific society, specific historical time. We even have specific details about the Roman Empire, who was emperor and so forth at that time, to place it in its historical context. So these are just basic facts that we should keep in mind. And then if we do have them in mind, it may change how we look at the actual text. Finally, I wanted to mention on the issue of translation in general. In the non-biblical world, if you will, all translations contain qualifications and provisos in the introduction, saying that, you know, no translation is perfect and you always lose something when you try to bring it over from the original language. If you look in any literary translation of German or Italian or Russian literature, you'll find such an introduction where the translator is apologizing and hesitant and so forth. Unfortunately, if biblical translations contain these types of prefaces, and oftentimes they don't, but even when they do, people don't read them. And that's a problem because the English or the Spanish or the French is treated as the Word of God in an unreflective manner. And there are a lot of consequences to this. I mentioned before that people argue about different things in different languages because the texts imply different things in different languages. And the number of things that we could discuss goes on and on. It would never end if we were to consider the translation as the source of the truth, just because languages are different. So that's one thing that people should more generally keep in mind, even without going into all of the specific details that we've been looking at, the specific inaccuracies, that a translation will lose something, it will change something. It's inevitable in translating from one language to another. Okay, now, why don't you tell me about chapter 7, because I read the wrong chapter.
It was in the email.
Something that popped into my mind was the horrors of Roman torture and the arenas and whatnot, and how strong a controlling influence the fear of that would be on people who had the option of opting out of being exposed to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it might influence people to get into a groove of, we're going to go with the overlords.
Right. All right. Anyone else want to comment on the chapter? What's the main point that's being advanced?
That the rulers were corrupt. And that had something to do with their motivations, their negative motivations.
Okay. On what basis is this assertion made?
They were controlled by Rome.
Okay, that's part of it, yep.
Oh, money and power.
Yeah, money and power. What's the evidence that we have that, for example, the chief priests and Pharisees and scribes were not acting in accordance with God's will or biblical guidelines? Do we have any evidence of that, or is it just speculation on the basis that they were representing Rome? Okay.
In the Talmud, it says that they took the skins for themselves of the animals that were sacrificed, and they used it for their... They wouldn't even give any of the skins to, the people who sacrificed the animal. It was all not only just... Not even for the priests. The high priest took all the skins for themselves, and who knows what they... they probably sold it by the side for big profit.
Okay, and especially in Josephus as well, you have descriptions not just of the high priests of the time of Yeshua, but also before and after. And with regard to the high priest Ananias, who is mentioned in the scriptures about Yeshua, Josephus says he was a great hoarder up of money. He also had servants who were very wicked, and so forth. They beat those who wouldn't give them the tithes, and so forth. In other words, they were extorters, according to Josephus. And we have these various historical sources that give this type of, negative characterization of their personality, if you want to put it that way. But in addition, the scriptures themselves describe them very clearly as not following the will of God and not being concerned with what was right. We talked previously about how even Pilate recognized that they delivered Yeshua up out of jealousy, out of envy. And then in this chapter, you have, I think, in a little bit more detail, some of the other scriptures that talk about them and their motivations. And also the actual charges that they brought against Yeshua.
Right.
So let me see if I can find... a few of these passages. Well, obviously, one of the main conflicts that they had with Yeshua was the issue of authority. Their authority derived from Rome, and his authority derived from God. And in this chapter, you have that discussed in some detail.
And the way they behaved in the temple itself. Mm-hmm. Turning it into a den of thieves as opposed to keeping it a house of prayer.
Right. And then I think part of the argument that is expressed is basically the idea that in their charges against Pilate, they brought political charges against him. So it was not that he was... violating God's commandments in a particular way. He was doing something that would challenge their authority and their place under the Roman Empire. These charges are given on page 97, for example. Does anyone remember what some of the charges were?
Subverting our nation, opposes payment of taxes to Caesar, and claims to be Messiah, a king.
Okay, yeah.
That's just something further on.
That's a
bomb. Right. Right. Now, I mean, the statement is made again in this chapter about how little the people probably knew about what was going on, how the high priests and rulers of the people had gathered their own crowd together, a multitude, it says, went with Judas, and he betrayed Yeshua. And they brought him before, you know, this crowd brought Yeshua before the Sanhedrin and then later before Pilate on the basis of certain charges. Originally, they tried to find witnesses who would testify against him, but even the witnesses were contradictory and so forth. You probably remember the story. But the charges that they finally came up with when they tried to put him to death was that he was preaching rebellion against Rome, which wasn't true, that he was preaching tax rebellion, in other words, not to pay the taxes, which also wasn't true, and that he claimed to be a king. And that's the charge that stuck, in a sense. That's the charge for which he was put to death. Pilate puts his crime on the cross, saying, "This is Yeshua of Nazareth, King of the Jews." A crime to be a king if you're not appointed by Caesar. And basically, the argument here is that the leaders, in this instance, selected those accusations very carefully, knowing the way the Roman Empire operated, and knowing that Pilate would be placed in a difficult predicament, that either he had to execute Yeshua on these charges, or he placed himself in danger of appearing in a bad light before Rome.
But we knew those charges, well, except the king part, were not true, because at one point in the Gospels he even says, whose picture is on the money? And give mm-hmm. render to Caesar what is Caesar's, and you know, to God what is God's.
Yeah.
So that obviously wasn't true, but ironically enough, the one thing they did stick on the cross when they crucified him was King of the Jews.
Right.
Which, he was a king, but yeah. his kingdom was much bigger than just the Jews.
So well, he does identify himself as King of the Jews. It's right. I mean, that is his title. And we discussed last time, in fact, how these other two charges weren't true. You know, in his teaching, he was not advocating rebellion. He said, "Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's," in a brilliant response to that attempt to trick him on the tax issue. But he was a king. And so that's what ended up sticking. Now, were there any other difficult passages or questions about this chapter in particular? Because actually, as I look over it, I think we covered quite a bit of it last time, mm-hmm. in fact. A large part of it is still following up on the issue of how the people responded versus how the leaders responded. Again, for example, at the bottom of page 98, all the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." All the people means all the people who were there, not all the people in the world, not all the people who are Jews, not even all the people who were then in Jerusalem. And we're told basically who was there. In several passages over and over again. It was the chief priests and the rulers from the Sanhedrin and some other people that they had gathered together, maybe others as well, but those are the basic people that we're told over and over again were there. Now, in Christian interpretation, of course, this is usually given to refer to all Jews, and all Jews were held guilty for the crime of killing Christ.
But who was it who ultimately crucified the Messiah?
Isaiah says in 53, all of us like sheep have gone astray. Mm-hmm. So that can mean the whole world.
Mm-hmm. But it's also, what I'm referring to is that it was God's plan.
God's plan.
It wasn't a surprise. Yeshua knew it was coming. He prayed before it. You know, if this cup could pass from me, so be it. But if not, Father, thy will be done, not my will. He knew what was coming. He knew it was going to be horrible. He knew it was going to be horrendous and horrific. But he went through it anyway because of the love he had for us, and that was God's plan. So in a sense, yes, all of us were responsible for crucifying the Messiah, but
because of our sins,
past, present, and future. But the bottom line was his crucifixion had to happen because it was God's plan.
Exactly.
What did you say, Fred, previously about the did you speak of the natural like the Hebrew translation or the...
Isaiah 53. Even the English interpretation is just right. You know, all of us like sheep have gone astray.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I meant necessarily in quotes, all the people. Are Jewish people referred to as the people of God? Is that potentially how it could have been twisted that way? I wasn't sure how it was originally written.
Well, they're referred to as the people of God, and that's the subject of another chapter as well. But it's not saying that here. It's just saying all the people answered. It's talking about, you know, a description of a scene. It's not saying all the people of God said this. The question of who killed Yeshua is something that we could discuss, and people do discuss all the time. It's not really the topic of this book, but I think Bobby is right that, first of all, it pleased God to put him to death. Secondly, he said, "No man takes my life, I lay it down."
Mm-hmm.
And then thirdly, the scriptures show that a variety of different people bear responsibility for their actions. First of all, Pilate, who cannot get out of his guilt by saying, "I wash my hands of it, it's your fault." He's the one doing it. You can't do something wrong and say, "Well, I'm free of guilt by washing my hands." You're still responsible for what you do. And in fact, he was the one who had the authority to make the decision. And if you remember in the account, his wife actually had a dream in which she was warned in some way, and she sent word to him saying, "Don't do anything to this man." Nonetheless, he chose to do it. So the idea that the judge can make an unjust decision, make a false decision, and say, "Well, I wash my hands of it," and thereby pass the responsibility to someone else is just a false conception.
I don't think I was suggesting blame, etc.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I wasn't responding to you, but just to the general question of which keeps coming up of who killed Yeshua. So Pilate does bear some responsibility. The scriptures assign a lot of responsibility to the chief priests and the rulers of the people who wanted him killed and who got him killed. And all people bear some responsibility, as Bobby was saying.
Yeah, just to back up this more, the Torah even foretells that, in the sacrifices, has a sacrifice if the ruler of the people sins, which was in this case Pilate, or Herod, whoever you may choose. Besides, Herod wasn't a Jew anyway, he was an Edomite, but you have Ananias, who is a priest, and it has a sacrifice for the priest if he sins, and it even has a sacrifice for the high priest if he sins. In the Torah, 2,000 years before this, or 1,500 years before this happened, and it also has a sacrifice if all the people together sin. So this is completely covered in God's plan, that this God knew it would happen, and he provided the atonement. So even though one may have been directly killed him or something, even they're covered by the temple sacrifices that were proclaimed 1,500 years before this happened. So it doesn't mean anything, to point your finger and say, "Who killed Yeshua?" It doesn't matter.
Especially if he gave his life up.
Yes.
But of course, people have pointed fingers quite a bit, which is why the topic comes up. Even so, the basic point of this chapter is just very simply, again, the distinction between the people and the rulers. The people eagerly listened to Yeshua on page 99. The people did not support the brutal Roman rule, nor the corrupt Sanhedrin which enforced it. When Yeshua was led through the city, a large number of people followed him, including women who mourned and wailed for him. These were Jewish people. And so forth. How did the disciples of Yeshua view the crucifixion? As they explained to a risen Yeshua whom they did not recognize, the chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. That is the simple biblical view. And that's obviously been missing from most interpretation of the scriptures.
That line is missing from...
No, this idea, this understanding is missing from most interpretation of the scriptures. I mean, when's the last time you heard, in the last 2,000 years, someone put forward this point of view, that it was the chief priests and the rulers of the people who delivered Yeshua up to death, and the Jews as a whole were actually opposed to this action and were accepting of Yeshua. It's not a common viewpoint.
No, Catholics specifically teach that the Jews killed Jesus.
Yeah, I think
I
they...
I had a Catholic friend and she broke up with me because I disagreed with his, right. his idea. That right. was,
mm-hmm. Yeah, most Christians still hold to that belief. Yeah.
I've heard lots of preachers talk about that. I mean, they just talk about it from a biblical point of view, and they just read it and accept that. They're evangelical, they're not Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Except what?
They're evangelical pastors that have preached.
What do they accept?
They would say that the Jewish people, that Jesus was Jewish, and that he was killed by an Italian, someone from the Roman Empire, that the chief priests were the ones that killed him, and the followers were Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah. The Romans followed the instructions of the yeah. high priest. And the point I made last week is like when you say the people answer, now, it was always such a distinction that the people that were there and there it very clearly says the Jewish people answered, put him to death.
Right.
Where so many times it would say in the Testament that okay, the people did this, and then some Jewish people did this, and then these other people did this, and then some Jewish people did this. But in that particular instance, the Jewish people answered, put him to death.
Right.
And the Romans were just simply following the instructions of these poor Jewish people that they had been oppressing all this time.
Right.
How wonderful of them to be. All of
suddenly
a sudden
so
now
much power. Go,
yes.
Yeah. So yeah. I think you're saying two different things, though. What you're saying is that... the way you've heard it presented is that it's almost as if the Jews were above the Romans.
Right.
And the Jews could tell the Romans what to
exactly,
do.
Exactly. In that particular instance, yeah. it's like, you know, defies all the other stuff in history where the Romans, you know, dictated to the Jews. But in that particular instance, the Jew wanted it, and so the Romans just kind of followed.
Right. And what you're saying is also related to the next chapter, which I think we'll get into a little bit, because it's very hard not to discuss this issue of the Jews. Mm-hmm. While we're discussing these types of questions. What Leslie is saying, though, is different, is that I think Leslie was saying is that she has heard a lot of Christian preachers treat this accurately.
I've heard some, too.
Yeah.
But it's still making equivalent that rulers who were also Jewish, so it is true that Jews actually handed him to soldiers.
Well, yes, but in the same sense that, you know, it's always true when someone of a particular nationality does anything. In other words, the way it's usually portrayed is that the Jews, as a nation, as a people, did this. Committed deicide is the traditional Christian description. And even Catholicism has moved away from that in the 20th century, but it's taken a very long time to get to that point. Even, you know, evangelicals tend to move a little farther or a little faster. But I think still, even if you would ask the typical evangelical Christian about this, mm-hmm. their common belief would still be that the Jews killed Christ, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I've heard the version that Jews still had a choice,
mm-hmm.
you know, to agree or to disagree with the decision.
And right. what if they had disagreed? God had already decided it was going to happen.
So they didn't have a choice.
So it didn't really matter whether they agreed or disagreed. God mm-hmm. had already decided.
Right. I mean, again, yeah, I don't... There are a lot of different questions here, but really the point that we can agree on, I think, is that the portrayal in the scriptures is different than what you may generally get. From the Christian perspective, and the portrayal in the scriptures is simply of the historical situation at the time, where you had the Roman Empire, you had underneath it a Jewish collaboration government, and then you had the rest of the people. And there's a fairly clear distinction made between these three different groups and their roles in what transpired. Yeah.
In recent history, we've had Hollywood to thank and other filmmakers as well for kind of leaving out the fact that these people were hand-picked
mm-hmm.
in this crowd. as opposed to a like a collection of people, some who didn't know him, who liked Barabbas for whatever reason. You know, I've never seen it depicted in the way that it's presented in your dad's book.
Okay. In film, you mean? You haven't seen it presented that way?
In film, you haven't seen it presented that way.
Yeah.
Not reading this book.
Right. And by the way, it says when Judas went to betray Yeshua, he took with him Roman soldiers. He was given the Roman cohort to take with him. So it wasn't only Jews, by the way, that he went with. He went with the Romans, sent with, you know, the authority of the high priests who were part of the Roman government.
Apparently they didn't know him because they needed somebody to point him to
apparently, yeah. So they weren't part of the crowds that had been following him, that's for sure. Those people.
But we also know that his followers were Jewish, based on the fact that they said the Sabbath is coming and they took his body down. And then they couldn't even prepare it because they couldn't touch a dead body on the Sabbath. So they put him in the tomb and had to go away and celebrate the Sabbath and couldn't come back until after the Sabbath. These are things that Gentiles would not have cared about. They would not have kept the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as another strong indication that his followers were mostly Jewish, and the Jews had accepted him. It was those who were put in the leadership position that, again, to quench the Roman thirst, you know, to keep them under from having rebellions all over that part of the world.
Well, also throughout his ministry and for a considerable period of time afterwards, it was very unusual for a Gentile to be involved. And it's, you know, mentioned as being unusual when a Gentile is involved. So again, it's just a question of where he was from and, you know, who he was interacting with. It's something that should be obvious, but often hasn't been so obvious.
In Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, that scene has a multitude, and that subscript is actually omitted.
Right.
His blood be upon us. And you see, if it had just been whoever was there in the biblical account, it would not need to be omitted because it's not saying, let this nation.
Right.
The nation has said, let his blood be upon us.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there is one particular translation issue that contributes to this idea. And that's in chapter 8, which I assume some of you have read and some of you haven't read. But this is talking about the usage in John of the word that most people translate as the Jews. So if you read some of the other Gospels, people would argue perhaps it's true that not all of the Jews rejected him. Perhaps it's true that not all of the Jews were involved. But if you read John, the argument goes, there it's clearly stated the Jews did this, the Jews did that, the Jews, you know, said whatever they said. And in fact, if you do read it in an English translation or in any other translation, it does appear that the Jews are responsible for rejecting and crucifying Yeshua. that's the way the translation makes it sound. So that particular issue has contributed very significantly to what we've been discussing so far. The word in Greek or Jewish Greek is Iudaioi, which is a transliteration of Yehudim, the word that originally referred to people from the tribe of Judah and then referred to people from the southern kingdom when Israel was divided into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, and eventually came to be the word for all Jews. Now, if you haven't read this chapter, you can look at it later and you'll probably discover a lot of interesting things. I don't think it will be too problematic to talk about it if you haven't, because a large part of the chapter, again, is just quotations of the different usages so that you can see what is described. And the basic argument in the chapter is that Iudaioi does have these different meanings. It can mean all Jews, or it can very often mean Judeans, people from Judea, or it can even mean very specifically the political religious authorities of Judea, of Jerusalem. And that is what is very helpful in explaining the particular issue of who was responsible for turning Yeshua over to Pilate and so forth. Yes.
I don't know enough Greek or hardly any Greek, but is this any specific form? Is it genitive or something? Or?
No, this is just a plural nominative.
Okay.
But obviously it appears in all of the different cases. But the nominative just means the simple form of the noun. Mm-hmm. So the issue of how to translate it is actually rather important if all these statements are being made in this one book about this group of people. It's noted in this chapter that Eudaio appears only 4 times in the first 3 Gospels, but some 50 times in John or Yohanan. So the usage is very different in that one book. Now, before we get into how it's used in that particular book, I just wanted to give you a little bit of evidence that other people have recognized this problem. For example, Shuhaki, who I've referred to a few times, the French translator, doesn't translate Eudaioi, which is a transliteration. Instead, he transliterates, and he puts Yehudim. And that, again, transliteration implies that you can't really express the concept in your target language. So what he's saying is that if you were to translate as Jew or Judean or anything else, it would be inaccurate. It would not be consistent with the way this Greek word is used. So he chooses transliteration. And of course, note that it's already a transliteration in Greek. So I suggested earlier that it's a good idea if your text has a transliteration in it that you should probably use a transliteration in your translation as well. Because even in Greek, obviously, they didn't have a different word to describe what they meant. The second thing I wanted to point out to show how this has been interpreted outside of this particular book is an article from the Harvard Theological Review, which is a well-known scholarly publication. And the article is called On the Meaning of the Term Jew in Greco-Roman Inscriptions by Ross Kramer. It's from 1989. And basically, the article starts out by saying that the word Eudaioi, or Eudaios Eudaiae in the singular, and their Latin equivalents have generally been translated as Jew. But this isn't really the correct range of meaning for the term. He cites some other studies more recently that have suggested that actually it very often in Greek and Latin had a geographical significance, in other words, Judean. So in that case, Jew would be an incorrect translation because there were plenty of Jews who didn't live in Judea. There were Jews who lived in Galilee, there were Jews who lived in Alexandria, and so forth. So he cites several different studies of this nature. And then his own argument is that in his research, he's found cases where Eudaioi, in fact, refers not to Jews at all, but to pagans who adhere to Judaism in some way. So in other words, it was a term with a very broad range of meanings. Sometimes it referred to a subset of Jews. Sometimes it referred even to people who weren't Jews but showed an attachment to Judaism at the time. And again, this makes a little bit more sense if you think of the general context of the time, which is a very small Jewish world and a very large pagan world. There really isn't that much in between. So a word that has several layers of meaning and can even be applied to people from the general pagan world that try to attach themselves to the Jewish world sort of makes sense in that scenario. And then what my father's argument is in Copernicus is that these different types of meanings are actually evident from the context of the word where it appears, and that it can be compared to the word Yankee, for example, in English. So what does Yankee mean?
Northerner.
Okay, it can mean a Northerner. It can mean a North American.
Could mean the candle.
It could mean the candle. It could mean a New Englander.
But no, but for example, our two daughters were born and raised in Maryland. and one is married in Texas. And in Texas, she will always be the Yankee.
Right.
And the other one is up in Massachusetts on the border to New Hampshire, and for them, she is always going to be the Southerner.
Yeah. It depends on your perspective,
exactly.
I guess. Yeah.
Like his inclusion of the evil empire.
Right. Right. Well, it can refer to that particular baseball team as well.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
For all but, Americans. Overseas, right. It means all Americans.
Right. Yeah. So here's an example. Initially, it referred to Dutch settlers. In the American Civil War, Southerners used it to designate all Northerners. In the turbulent 1960s, it was used in Latin America to designate all citizens of the United States. So, the word Yankees can mean very different things depending on who's using it in what context. And I guess Udiary is somewhat similar in that sense in the Messianic writings. Now, the predominant case that is related to Chapter 7 is, of course, when it refers to the political religious authorities. When it can't refer to all Jews, according to the context, it can't even refer to all Judeans. According to the context, but it does refer specifically to the leaders of Israel. And we have this kind of usage today with regard to all nationalities. For example, when we follow international news and we read that the French signed a treaty with some other country, it doesn't mean that all the French people signed a treaty. It means that one or two French people who are at the head of the government signed a treaty. Or even, you know, the Americans launched a rocket into space today. Doesn't mean that all Americans were actually involved in it. Or the Germans discovered a cure for cholera or something like that. You know, it's often used even in our own language for a small subset of the nation. And so the argument in this chapter is that Udiary is also used that way in the Jewish Greek text of the scriptures about Yeshua. Yeah.
Bring out a dead horse. Are leaders held responsible, or are they representatives of the people as a whole? Even though there was this mob there made up of people who are not the leaders, the leaders did initiate the trial and whatnot. And is that a possible reason why they might be lumped together as the leaders being representatives?
Sure. I didn't fully understand the question.
Must be English. I was going back to the question of blame again, perhaps of the people being, you know, the Jewish people being considered responsible. Are leaders at that time actually held responsible as representatives of their people?
Appointed by Rome.
Whatever the leaders do, that represents what the people are doing.
Well, I guess to some extent, it's always true. We talked about this a little bit last time. Probably if we went around the table, we'd have different opinions on that. What I was suggesting last time was related to the example of David, you know, when he numbered the people, and that was a sin in God's eyes, and God punished the entire nation for it. So everyone was had to deal with the consequences of that. But even in the account of that sin, there was a clear distinction made between David and the other people, even his advisors, who themselves were not always righteous. But even they were going against him and telling him that he shouldn't do this. So a clear distinction was made in terms of who was responsible for it. But the distinction wasn't made in terms of who suffered the consequences. So I guess my perspective would be that because leaders do have that position, what they do may affect more people than those under them. But it doesn't make everyone under them guilty of what they did. That's my interpretation.
But they are the representatives.
Well, they weren't chosen by the people. It wasn't democratic. It was appointed by Rome. You've got to remember, right. Even in this nation that we call ourselves a democratic government,